History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the course of that effort, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. One thing I didn't mention on our last episode was that it was the 700th episode of this weekly program. We're now into our 15th year on the radio, which makes me grateful first and foremost for all the veterans all over this country who have given us a little window into their experiences so many years ago, but also thankful for all the radio stations who deliver those stories to your home, to your car, or wherever it is that you tune in. You can access any of those 700 episodes online at hometownheroesradio.com. And speaking of those affiliate radio stations, they always love hearing from their listeners. So if you're thankful, as I am, that they provide airtime for these veteran stories each weekend, maybe reach out to the station where you listen and let them know. For those of you joining us from California this weekend, San Francisco is launching Fleet Week. And while that can give you a taste of the latest and greatest the Navy has to offer and an annual air show that's hard to beat, I want to give a special shout out to our friends who maintain and operate the SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two World War II Liberty ships that is still fully functional. And if you go online and reserve tickets now, you might be able to cruise around San Francisco Bay on that historic World War II ship and even watch the Blue Angels performing from the deck of the O'Brien. I've got a link posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Our last episode was recorded in Modesto, California, and I really should have told you that there was a B-17 there last weekend. If you live in that area, you probably heard it flying over. It's the B-17 Sentimental Journey, and it does have one more stop on its Flying Legends of Victory tour. This weekend, that historic bomber is in Chino, California at the Plains of Fame Air Museum. They might even have a couple of ride slots still available. That's another link I have posted for you online. And that plane also inspired the theme of today's show. Looking at the B-17 Sentimental Journey took me on a sentimental journey through a few of the moving B-17 stories we've heard over the years sprinkled among those 700 episodes. And I want to begin with one of the most famous photos of a B-17 ever. It inspired the song and the feature film Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer, because that photo shows that that's exactly what happened. Ralph Burbridge was the bombardier on that B-17 and the last surviving crew member when I had a chance to sit down with him in Arizona before his passing. I wanted to read him the email narrative that may have shown up in your inbox a time or two over the years and allow Ralph to confirm or deny some of those details. A mid-air collision on February 1st, 1943, between a B-17 and a German fighter over the Tunis dock area became the subject of one of the most famous photographs of World War II. An enemy fighter attacking a 97th Bomb Group formation went out of control, probably with a wounded pilot, then continued its crashing descent into the rear of the fuselage of a fortress named All American, piloted by Lieutenant Kendrick R. Bragg of the 414th Bomb Squadron. When it struck, the fighter broke apart but left some pieces in the B-17. The left horizontal stabilizer of the fortress and left elevator were completely torn away. The two right engines were out, and one on the left had a serious oil pump leak. The vertical fin and the rudder had been damaged. The fuselage had been cut almost completely through, connected only at two small parts of the frame, and the radios, electrical, and oxygen systems were damaged. There was also a hole in the top that was over 16 feet long and 4 feet wide at its widest, and the split in the fuselage went all the way to the top gunner's turret. All right, so far, does that all sound accurate?
Yeah.
Sounds familiar. February 1st, 1943. We're going to tell you where Ralph was on this plane in a minute, but let's continue the story. Although the tail actually bounced and swayed in the wind and twisted when the plane turned, and all the control cables were severed except one single elevator cable still working, the aircraft still flew, miraculously. Do you think miraculously is fair to say there?
Yeah, that's all right. It was a miracle, all right.
All right. Well, let's continue. The tail gunner was trapped because there was no floor connecting the tail to the rest of the plane. The waist and tail gunners used parts of the German fighter and their own parachute harnesses in an attempt to keep the tail from ripping off and the two sides of the fuselage from splitting apart. While the crew was trying to keep the bomber from coming apart, the pilot continued on his bomb run and released his bombs over the target. Now, you were the bombardier on this plane. Is that true?
Well, no. I think we had already bombed when that crash happened.
That makes more sense to me because you would have had a hard time keeping your speed up.
We couldn't do that, no.
All right. So, see, this is why we check the accuracy of these things making their way around the Internet. So there's one thing we've caught, but let's continue and see what else. When the bomb bay doors were open, the wind turbulence was so great that it blew one of the waist gunners into the broken tail section. You remember that?
No, I don't. Sammy Sorpolos was back there. He had a hard time getting out of that tail gunner's position. He had to have help.
Because there was nothing connecting the tail to the rest of the plane except that elevator cable, right?
As far as I know, yeah. It was a Boeing engineer said it was impossible for it to fly. Yeah.
Impossible. That's why he said it was a miracle. Eventually, Allied fighters intercepted the All-American and took some of the pictures. And this is the famous picture that went all the way around. It says here that 2.5 hours after it was hit, the aircraft finally made its final turn to line up with the runway, descended into an emergency landing and a normal rollout on its landing gear. When the ambulance pulled alongside, it was waved off because not a single member of the crew had been injured. No one could believe that the aircraft could still fly in such a condition. The fortress sat placidly until the crew all exited through the door in the fuselage and the tail gunner had climbed down a ladder, at which time the entire rear section of the aircraft collapsed onto the ground. That rugged old bird had done its job. Is that what you remember?
Yeah, it fell apart after we landed, yeah. What was it, something that we did, just a simple thing and it landed. I mean, the tail fell off. Collapsed, rather. It's a long time ago.
All right, so now we've heard that story that's making the rounds, but now let's get it from Ralph Burbridge's perspective.
Of course, we were outnumbered all the time. The Germans had the Messerschmitt 109 and the Focke-Wulfs that were air-cooled engines. The Messerschmitt, of course, was a water-cooled engine. They would bore in. When they first started over there, they tried everything. They came in on the tail. That was a mistake. Those tail gunners sit back there with 250s. They unloaded on them. So they could quit that. Then they came in on head-on attacks, 12 o'clock high. You've heard of that? Well, that's what it was. They'd be up here. That's the nose of the plane, 12 o'clock. Wherever the plane is 12 o'clock. And they'd come in high. That's what happened there. They came in at 12 o'clock high.
On the February 1st mission, yeah. The famous one. Yeah. And if they're coming 12 o'clock high, the bombardier, you, are sitting in the nose of that airplane. Yeah. And all that's separating you from these planes is a little sheet of plexiglass, and you've got some guns up there.
Yes. At that time, the bombardiers only had a 30 caliber. But later on, when the B-17G came out, they put 250s up front, too. But that's what I had. It was a day to remember.
So on that day, as you recall, you guys had already dropped your bombs when these fighters come in. So you see a German fighter plane coming right at your airplane.
I'm just like I'm sitting here by that window 6 feet away.
So, is it not giving it justice to say it was kind of like a game of chicken? There's a plane flying straight at you, and if you don't shoot it down, he's going to shoot you guys down?
I'll tell you one thing. The guy that blinks is dead. So you don't blink. You pour fire into him.
So you are sitting there, gripping this 30 caliber, firing away as fast as you can, and saying a prayer that this isn't your final moment?
Well, I wasn't saying a prayer. I was probably cussing the son of a gun.
And I'm sure you weren't alone in that. What happened? You believe that you put some of those bullets in him, that whether it killed the pilot or not at that point, it debilitated that aircraft, yeah. And he crashed into the tail section.
Yeah, that's what happened. He was. I'm quite sure he was dead rather than heavily wounded. He could have been either one, but... He came right into us, boy, I'll tell you. He felt like he could reach out and touch him, but he crashed above and into the, the B-17 tails high. He came down, and you could see how it sliced. He came in there, boy.
And at the time, you're in the nose of that airplane. it's hard for you to see what's happening. But what did that feel like? Was it a major jolt to the aircraft?
Jolt. Plane went up, nose rose up a little like this, and then down a little, and then Ken brought it under control, straight and level. Like I said before, squadron grouped around us then, protect us. We went back to base.
When did you guys realize the extent of the damage to your airplane?
Well, I didn't know till we landed, because I was up in the front of the plane.
That was probably a good thing, huh?
Yeah. You know, I think about Sammy Sorpolis, our tail gunner. He looked up. Boy, I'll tell you, he knew what was there happening.
I know you guys had flown some missions together before, and I'm sure you had a tight-knit crew, but you're about as close to your pilot, Ken, as anybody else was at that point. What do you remember about the way he handled that situation?
He handled it well. That's why we're alive. Yeah, Ken was a great guy.
I mean, because I look at that picture, and I imagine chaos on this B-17, but I don't hear you saying that it was chaotic.
No. No use being chaotic about it. You're sliced up.
You don't remember any conversation about bailing out or parachutes or anything?
Well, I think we said, Ken said he could keep it under control. We didn't worry too much about it. At least I didn't, because I really didn't know how bad it was, to tell you the truth, up there in the front, see? Those waist gunners and tail gunners, they knew, and the radio gunner knew it. They really knew. And top turret, he was also the engineer on the plane. He knew it. So it was lucky we got back.
For you, ignorance was bliss?
Yeah, you bet.
So when Mr. Bragg did land that plane and you got off the plane and then you saw the extent of the damage, what was your reaction?
Oh, boy, I thought, how do we ever live through this? It amazed me, to tell you the truth, mm-hmm. that we could even be alive.
I know once that picture went around, everybody was excited about it. But at the time, do you remember people reacting to your crew as you walked away? Were they shocked and astonished?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they were astonished. They were mostly airmen there, you know. They knew the airplanes.
When did you guys, your crew, when did you realize what a worldwide phenomenon that photo had become, that people all over the world had seen it?
We didn't know much. They didn't let us know much. Didn't let us write home and tell much, you know, because I think all our letters were censored anyhow. It was just a situation where it's just part of combat, you know.
Do you remember when you first heard coming in on a wing and a prayer and that someone had dedicated it to you?
I don't even remember. It's been so long ago. Yeah, they dedicated it. And it was coming in on a wing and a prayer, too, believe me. He gives me the shivers. It really does. I'm not kidding you. I was glad to be alive, like any guy that flew in World War II, in combat in World War II, rather. I'm proud of serving my country like anybody that has done that. Proud of serving it. You know, I would never change that. My father died when I was 10. I grew up in a very religious home, so I guess there was somebody looking after me, or I wouldn't be here.
That was Ralph Burbridge from that B-17 All-American that came in on a wing and a prayer 78 years ago now. Still to come, two more hair-raising experiences in B-17s for men who ended up with the Purple Heart and whose resilience is sure to inspire. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer, though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on, coming in on a wing and a prayer.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode focused on B-17s. If you're in Southern California this weekend, you can catch the B-17 Sentimental Journey flying above the Plains of Fame Air Museum in Chino. One of the more memorable B-17 connections for me through the years came when I finally got to interview a heroic bombardier whose pilot had bragged to me about him a decade earlier. Let's hear first from that B-17 pilot, Bill McLeod, who experienced quite a bit while flying with the 303rd Bomb Group.
But what amazed me was the accuracy of the anti-aircraft. As we came in, we could see the anti-aircraft exploding ahead of us, and it was right at our altitude. They would be getting closer and closer, and finally they were in the formation. And that's where my bombardier got the Purple Heart, because some slivers of steel exploded and came into the nose of the airplane. And by the way, bombardiers were more casualties than any other position on the airplane. Anyway, he got hit with exploding plexiglass, which got into his eyes and his head. He wouldn't leave his position. He stayed there until it was time for bombs away. And we told him when to drop the bombs, and he flipped the switch. And then we took him back to the radio room where he received first aid. But we could hear the flak hitting the airplane. It was like gravel, throwing a handful of gravel at the plane. Fortunately, we just had one Purple Heart, and that was the only Purple Heart in all of my missions that I flew. He wouldn't evacuate. We tried to get him to leave, but he wouldn't. By the way, his name was Duke O'Donnell, and he was from Joliet, Illinois. I very, very much admired Duke for that, and I put him in for a medal after we got down. And then it was turned down. And later on in life, I got him the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Well, let's hear now from that blinded bombardier, Duke O'Donnell, and his memories of December 31st, 1944, from start to finish.
Well, we went to briefing, of course, which is first before the mission, find out about the target and any defenses they might have down there, how many guns they have. Anyway, so then we took off, got flown toward the target. I started seeing flak. They had three types of ways to shoot flak. Straight at the plane, or what we call tracking flak, which is the most accurate. They shoot ahead of you, and on the bomberman you can't deviate from course, so you have to fly right into it. And that was the case in this case. I looked up, and they had either four-gun batteries or six-gun batteries. And up ahead, I saw one shell go off, and then another one closer, and another one closer. And I knew they had at least four, and I knew we were going to be right there when I got hit. So I even said over the intercom, we're going to get hit. And the next thing I knew, I thought my head was gone. The top of my head was gone. I just sat there waiting to die. didn't bother me a bit. So anyway, I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to die right away. I can get these bombs out. So I told Mac, I said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs. So I was able to feel around. I couldn't see because I had glass in my eye. So he said, there they go. So I felt the toggle switch, which you can get the bombs out that way. And so I got them out that way. And then I was really out of my head for the rest of the day. Maybe ever since, I don't know. But anyway, Mac says, go back to the radio room. So I couldn't see, so I got up, and the top turret gunner, the engineer, helped me along. And I thought myself, I'll jump out of the plane to make it lighter. They can get back to England easier. if I lighten the load up a little bit, you see how it's out of my head. So the engineer, DeWillers, took my parachute off of the chest pack so I could get through the narrow catwalk to the radio room, but I did have sense enough not to jump out without a parachute, huh? So anyway, I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors, but anyway. So we went back to the radio room, and then we had to make a forced landing. We thought there were no brakes. Mac did, the pilot. So we landed, and then they did finally have some brakes, so we were okay there. And then the ambulance came to take me to the hospital, and they'd say, like, was it a rough mission? And I'd try to write the right answer, but something like, it's going to rain next Tuesday or something would come out, you know. So I went to the hospital, and I think the next day I was okay. Of course, maybe the other guys say, I don't know. So I stayed there a week in the hospital, and then came back. And I flew a couple of missions, and then they trained me as a GH navigator, which was it was a new invention by an Englishman. You'd have two radio signals, sending stations, about 100 miles apart right behind our lines, and each would send out a signal. The plane would fly along one signal, and when it got to the other one, that was the target, so you dropped the bombs then.
I didn't want to interrupt you because I wanted to hear the story from your perspective as you remember it, but people listening are saying, boy, this guy is describing this like it's no big deal. But the first thing you said was, all of a sudden, after you saw, you know, one piece of flak closer, another burst closer, you told everyone we're going to get hit. The next thing you know, you thought the top of your head was blown off. So this flak exploded right in the nose of the plane, knocked out the plexiglass, knocked it into your eyes, and you're blind, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. No, couldn't see. But the plexiglass, of course, that all crumbled, you know, breaks up in little pieces. I have my face, my eye, and my nose.
So it's basically like a buckshot going into your face, only plexiglass.
Yeah, right. That's about it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't see. You're feeling your face. You probably feel a lot of blood, and you really thought that half your head was blown off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But you stayed at your position to drop your bombs. And this is what your pilot, Bill McLeod, told me was so impressive that inspired the rest of your crew. They all wanted to take you back and give you medical attention. You said, no, I want to drop these bombs. But you're saying that wasn't necessarily a conscious thought, that you were pretty out of it.
You get so trained, I think, to it that dropping the bombs is the one thing you're thinking about. So you don't, yeah, you don't want to change your mind. You just want to get the bombs out and then figure out like I say, I wasn't too sensible either.
Did you ever find out how many pieces of plexiglass they pulled out of you?
No, I don't know. They were... there's still one in my nose, but it doesn't bother me any. And so I don't know how many they probably threw them away. I don't know.
So the one that's still in your nose, you can feel it internally, or you can rub your finger over it and feel it?
I can feel it right. I'm feeling it right now. Yeah, it's up in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right inside of your left eye, there's a little spot on the bridge of your nose.
Right in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So at the time, you're still there in the bombardier position in the nose. Of course, the glass is shot out. Not that you could see it anyway. You're completely blind, and you needed help from your crew in order to know when to flip that switch and drop the bomb. So how did that work?
Well, I called Mac, the pilot, and said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs, because we were in formation. So when the other ones dropped their bombs, I was able to find this, what they call the toggle switch, and got them out that way.
You know, and Bill had never told me this part, because maybe he didn't know what was inside your head. He just told me about, you know, he wanted you to get a Distinguished Flying Cross for that. You did receive the Purple Heart. But this whole thing about when they're taking you back to get medical attention, that you thought about jumping out of the plane. You really thought your extra weight was going to cost the crew?
Well, as I say, I was kind of out of my head. And I was thinking, if I jump out, it'll make it easier for them to get back to England. So I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors. But the engineer, as I say, took my parachute off, the chest pack parachute off me. And so I couldn't jump. I did have enough sense not to jump without a parachute. That's what, so. Yeah. So I did get back to the radio room there.
But you were moments away, perhaps, from doing that. And I know you had 7 children, and now you have 6 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. So I know they're all thankful you didn't jump out there. But you're still blind and wounded. You know the plane's in trouble because you've been shot up. So what was the rest of that mission like for you until they got you to the ground?
Well, we went back in the radio room. I don't recall too much about it. We flew back, and then we got in a sitting position when you're going to make a crash landing. We thought there were no brakes, so we had to make a crash landing. And the pilot and the co-pilot and the I think the engineer were the only ones that could were doing their job. The rest of us all were sitting up against the wall in the radio room in case the plane, you know, we were backs to the wall of the radio room facing the front. And then I'd sit here and then somebody sit next to in front of me and then somebody in front of him. We make it as easy as we could if we crashed. I mean,
you're pretty much bracing for impact. And what's going on in your head? Are you clenching your teeth? You saying a prayer?
No, it didn't bother me a bit because, as I say, I was really out of it. You know? Uh-huh. So, no, what's new? So we made crash landing.
So they get you down. You're treated in the hospital. At what point were you able to see again? And was there some time where you thought, hey, I don't know if I'll ever see again?
Well, I never thought about not seeing again. But as I recall, well, they took me to the hospital. And when they took the glass out, I could see. I think it was quite sore, but I was able to see then, yeah.
That has to be a pretty good feeling, that maybe you appreciate your sight a little more after you've lost it for a while.
Yeah, of course, that was the same day, so I wasn't, I didn't know what I was doing. Next day, I appreciated it, yeah.
I know I'm bouncing around a little bit here, but again, you're just 19 years old at the time. You knew this was dangerous work before you got into it. In your heart of hearts, did you think you'd be coming home? Did you think you were going to see America again?
No, I tell you, first few weeks there, we were losing planes. Well, we were losing like at least one plane a mission. We had to fly 35 missions, and we put up 39 planes. So I figured, well, my chances of getting back are 4 out of 39. They aren't very good. So I didn't think I was going to make it. I thought it's only a matter of days or weeks or months at the most, and I'm done for. So I didn't think I was going to get back, but I did.
And it almost sounds like you were resigned to that fact. Was that a patriotic thing? Was that something from your faith? Or what do you think enabled you to keep doing what you were doing, knowing that there was a good chance you wouldn't come back?
Well, I think you're trained to do it. You feel it's your obligation to do it. Your friends are doing it. You do it too.
After you survive all that, you said it was only a few weeks before you were back in the air again?
Mm-hmm. Right. Back flying.
Was that hard? Were you? I mean, after you go through something like that.
I tell you, the first mission after I got hit, I was scared stiff. I tell you, about every 30 minutes, the bombardier takes an oxygen check because we had oxygen masks on. So I remember saying when the flak started, I tried to say over the intercom, oxygen check. Nothing came out. I was so scared.
You couldn't utter a sound.
No, but that was what we called a milk run, a real easy mission. No fighters and not too much flak. But the next one, that had been the next mission I flew, I don't know what would happen, because the briefing officer before the mission said there are 350 flak guns down there. They had, as I say, several ways of firing it, but one was box flak, they called. And they put everything they had up in the sky in the same place at the same time. And 350 artillery shells going off at the same place in the sky at the same time is quite a spectacle that happened in front of us in the next mission. If that had been the one previous.
And what did happen there? Because it sounds like I guess maybe an analogy would be you're going through a cheese grater or a paper shredder.
Yeah. We had a lot of damage that time to the ship, I know.
And when you're about to fly through it, and you're the guy in the front of the plane in that nose, do you close your eyes this time? Do you duck your head? What do you do?
No, you can't close your eyes or duck your head. You have to watch out for enemy fighters and watch out for the target and be on your best there, yeah. And the guy's been good to me, as you can tell.
Well, and he has been good to you, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when I go back to New Year's Eve in 1944, I get the feeling that you think he was there with you.
Well, he must have been. Yeah, I go along with that, agree with you.
That was Duke O'Donnell. And I know this reputation of World War II veterans is so humble that they downplay their heroics. It's almost become a cliche. But doesn't Duke's attitude reinforce what I would say is a genuine pattern? That's been my experience. And when we come back, another story in that vein from a wounded airman who was awarded the Silver Star for what he did after being shot up by a German jet. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a focus on B-17s today. One of the last ones flying, Sentimental Journey, is in the skies over Chino, California this weekend. But much more hostile skies over Europe during World War II were where a B-17 tail gunner named Vern Cole earned some significant decorations.
And on your wall are a Purple Heart medal as well as a Silver Star. And those are both the result of your 26th and final mission?
Right.
All right. Well, tell us about it. What was the mission? Where were you guys headed, and what did you think was going to happen that day in March of 1945?
We were flying to a place called Ruhland, R-U-H-L-A-N-D, Ruhland, Germany, which was 60 miles or so southeast of Berlin.
And you're flying all the way from your base in Italy, right?
Yes. It was a long flight, but we'd been up there the day before. I had not been on the previous mission, but our group had gone there the day before and had not got the target. And we had to go back. The Germans had moved in a bunch of extra aircraft weapons from Berlin. So the flak was extremely heavy when we went over there, over the target.
And the crew that you were flying with this day was not the same crew you had flown your previous 25 missions with, right?
Well, no, we didn't fly with the same crew every time. We flew whenever there was a chance to fly because we wanted to fill in our 35 missions and go home. So I volunteered when they needed a tail gunner for the crew across the street.
And I sense a pattern here, because all along the way, you've been given a way out or something you didn't need to do. And it sounds like you didn't need to go on this mission that day, but you said, hey, if they've got an opening, I'm taking it because it's going to get me to 35 missions sooner. Is that fair to say?
That's pretty fair to say. I wanted to get out of there.
And you had no problem volunteering, even though they say never volunteer for anything in the military.
No, that was one rule I never obeyed.
So this was a pilot named Skinner who was flying a plane called Beats Me Doc that day. Is that right?
That's right. Beats Me Doc.
And you're in the tail of that B-17.
Yes, all alone.
All by your lonesome. And so you told us what the target was, why you guys had to go back there. So what happened on that mission that changed your life forever?
Well, while we were over the target, one of the planes to my left was hit by flak and was all on fire, and the crew was bailing out, and I was paying attention to the crew bailing out. That was part of my job. I glanced to the right, and here were the damn ME-262s coming at us fast. I never saw anything so fast.
Now, and you had never seen a jet airplane before, right?
No, I had not seen ME-262s before. Or in a jet plane.
Had you heard they were out there, or was this like seeing a UFO for you?
Oh, we knew they were out there, but they rarely attacked B-17 groups because there was a lot of firepower in B-17 groups.
So you had trained as a tail gunner on shooting certain targets at certain speeds, and you'd probably seen ME-109s and some of the other German fighters before, and when you're shooting at them, they're going a certain speed, and you know how to follow them. So this was like a whole new ball game for you, I'm sure.
This was entirely different because I'd never seen anything so fast.
Well, what did you do? I can't imagine being in your shoes, and you probably feel overmatched right there.
Well, if I felt overmatched, it didn't last long because then I was wounded on the Jets' first pass. I was wounded, and the top turret gunner on our plane was killed. Several of the men bailed out because a lot of the plane wasn't functioning right. No communications, for example. The top turret gunner, as I said, was killed, and one waist gunner was killed in his chute on the way down.
And for those who don't know these aircraft, I think we've kind of illuminated it, but this really is a mismatch in terms of maneuverability. If you've got this big, heavy B-17 that's designed to go in and bomb, and then you've got the fastest airplane the world has ever seen at this point that's pretty much cherry-picking anything it wants. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. And the ME-262s didn't waste much time. They shot down four of our planes from our group that day.
And you already mentioned some of your crew killed. Others bailed out. They ended up becoming prisoners of war, some of them. And some of this that you're telling, you've learned after the fact, because when you were wounded, you lost consciousness, right?
That's right. I learned it all after the fact because we were bombing at 25,000 feet. I lost consciousness, and a couple of things saved my life. My flak suit saved my life when I was wounded, and the fact that the pilot immediately put the plane into a dive to get down to a lower altitude so I could breathe. My oxygen system was shot out, and I couldn't breathe otherwise, and I would have died if he hadn't brought us down to a lower altitude in a hurry.
So in terms of your flak suit saving your life, where were you hit, and how much worse would it have been without that flak suit?
I would have died without the flak suit. I was wounded in both arms and both shoulders and both hands, and my flak suit was kind of shredded. I can remember that.
And I'm sure everybody listening wants to know, when you did come to, when you regained consciousness, what did you realize? What were you thinking? And put us in your shoes. Try to help us understand what that must have been like, because I can't imagine.
Well, we had a choice every time we flew whether to wear the parachute or not. And this time I was not wearing a parachute. I was wearing a flak vest. After I was wounded, the first thing I remembered when I came to consciousness was, where's my parachute? Mm-hmm. And my hands and arms were kind of paralyzed in place, as if I were still holding the guns.
It sounds like a nightmare, to put it bluntly. And at that point, you believed you were the only person on the aircraft, right?
No, not at that point. I picked up my parachute with my teeth and carried it out into the waist. I crawled on my knees and got out into the waist, and there was nobody there, and the hatch door was open, and that's when I got really afraid. I thought I was all alone and that they had abandoned the plane. And I just sat there a moment when the ball turret gunner came out from the pilot's area, and I could have kissed him.
You're consistent, because I read in your book about this, that the same quote, that you could have kissed him, and that sounds like the genuine emotion that you felt at the time. You could have kissed him, but you still couldn't use your hands. You'd had to carry your parachute with your teeth, and you have to figure out what you're going to do, because this plane's not going anywhere but down, right?
Well, they were still flying it. They were heading east, heading into Russian territory. They told me about the top turret gunner being killed, and how they had rolled his body out and snapped the parachute open through the bomb bay doors. And they told me that the rest of the crew had bailed out and that there were just four of us left on the plane. The pilot, the co-pilot, the ball turret gunner. Oh, and a story, I had a waist gunner and myself. Four others on the plane beside myself. When the ball turret gunner tried to give me first aid, and he was a big fellow, never belonged in a ball turret in the first place.
Kind of a tight squeeze in that turret?
Yes, it was. Would have been. But he helped me out in another minute or two. I don't know anything about time now. Another minute or two, it seemed that the co-pilot came out. And the co-pilot was flying his first mission. He was a major who had been training people in the States and finally decided to get some combat experience. This was his first mission. he came out, and it was just about that time that four fighter planes showed up, and the waste gunner grabbed one of the waste guns. The co-pilot was going to try the other waste gun, and he didn't know how to use it, didn't know anything about a 50 caliber machine gun. In about 45 seconds, I gave him a complete lesson on how to maintain a B-17 machine guns. And he got on the other waste gun. The planes that were out there dropped their wheels, which meant they weren't going to attack. They saw we were already shot up, mm-hmm. and we were heading down. And they dropped their wheels, and they peeled away. But I got the Silver Star for teaching the major how to use a 50 caliber machine gun under the dire circumstances.
Obviously, it made an impression on him. He was probably the one that wrote you up for the Silver Star, right?
I have no doubt about it. I met him after the war, and we had long chats. He was from California, incidentally, San Diego. Mm-hmm. We had long chats after the war.
Well, and I can see why you got the Silver Star. When I try to put myself in your shoes, it had to have taken a lot of courage and concentration and really forgetting about what you were dealing with yourself, because you can't even use your hands. You're wounded terribly, and you were unconscious just moments before, but here you are having the presence of mind to try to help somebody else shoot down some planes. Where does that come from? How do you think you pulled that off?
I have no idea. It was just there when I needed it, and I have no experience in things like that before.
And in terms of the German fighter planes, now these are propeller planes, not the ME-262s who had crippled your plane. In terms of them putting down their wheels and leaving you alone, what did that mean to you then, and what does that mean to you now when you think of what they could have done to you if they wanted to?
They could have shot us down very easily, but it would have been a waste of ammunition because we were going down anyway.
So maybe it was as much practical as it might have been noble or respectful?
Yes, I don't think it was noble or respectful. Besides, they were getting pretty well over Russian territory by then, and they probably didn't want to see any Russian planes.
That makes sense, but still, you must have been pretty thankful they did what they did for your own sake.
Yes, that was the whole story of it all. Well, they unhooked my flak vest first. That was done before the other plane showed up anyway, and put my parachute on. It was a waste ball, and hooked the parachute up, and then when they decided they were far enough into Russian territory, they were going to bail out. The pilot and co-pilot figured this out. When they decided they were going to bail out, they gave a signal to the waste gunner who was standing at the door of the cabin, and he signaled me to go on out, and I just rolled on out into the, and the strap connected my parachute to the plane, and it pulled the parachute open as I got away from the plane.
Because you still don't have the use of your arms, either one of them, right?
I had no use of my arms or hands, and it was a beautiful spring day, and I bailed out. Never forgot that.
I don't know if I would have been thinking about the beautiful spring day had I been in your shoes. And I'm sorry to be repetitive here, but you don't have the use of your arms. Normally, that's what you're going to use, your hand, to open your chute. But they basically rigged up a remote control apparatus to pull your chute for you after you were out of the plane.
That's exactly what happened.
That takes some pretty good ingenuity, doesn't it?
No, it's been done before. We were deep into the war at that time. And I'm sure that had been done on numerous planes before.
So they had heard of it or seen someone else do it or had an idea of what to do in that situation?
Yes, they found the strap, and from then on it was easy. Up one end of the parachute and the other end of the plane.
Easy for you to say. I can't imagine it was easy floating down. You said a beautiful spring day, but then you're floating helplessly down toward the earth. You can't use either one of your arms at all. What are you thinking? And was that a short trip down to the surface, or did that seem to kind of drag on forever?
No, it was a relatively short trip. By this time, we were down less than 5,000 feet, I think. And I liked the situation. I was going to be on land again. And I had picked out a field. Before I bailed out, I picked out a field where I thought I could land in an open field. And there was one tree in the field. And the tree caught my parachute, so the parachute didn't blow away. My feet landed on the edge of a ditch, and I slid down the ditch and hit my rump. And that saved me from breaking ankles when I landed. And I had all kinds of good things happen to me that day. I was sitting there with my feet in the ditch, wondering what I was going to do next because I couldn't use my arms and hands yet. And I saw something moving in the edge of the woods. There was forest all around us. When I finally saw a young boy, probably 12, 13 years old, at the edge of the forest, and I yelled at him, and didn't make any difference. He couldn't understand me. But he came out very cautiously and got to my parachute, pulled my parachute down from the tree, and cut with the jackknife, cut the straps with a jackknife, and ran away back into the woods, stuck in my parachute behind him. And I thought, oh, hell, there goes my chance.
Well, and did you have any way of knowing who controlled the territory you were falling into? I know you were trying to get to Russian territory, but who did you expect was going to find you?
I didn't know at all. And I didn't know whether it was a German boy or Polish or Russian or whoever. I sat there a while longer, and I could hear a truck coming through the woods and hear the branches hitting the sides of the truck. And the truck came up, and here were four men on the back of the truck standing there with their rifles. They jumped down and came to me. And there was a woman riding in the passenger seat in the truck. And she came out and she spoke English. She determined that I was an American airman. And from then on, I was taken good care of. They loaded me on the back of the truck. She drove me into a little town, and they got a doctor there. And the doctor, I'll never forget, had a beard that went down to his waist. He came out and checked me over, listened to my heart, and gave me a shot in the chest. Then they loaded me back in the truck, and they took me to a Russian field hospital, like a MASH unit. And it was on the second floor of a building, and the first floor had been shelled out, probably tank shot out. They had to carry me up the stairs, wooden stairs on the outside, and they carried me up the stairs into this hospital, and they took care of me there. And to take care of my wounds, they brought out four water glasses on a tray, and the water glasses were filled with vodka. And they started pouring vodka down me until I passed out. After I passed out, they cleaned my wounds and bandaged them.
I guess that's when you know when you're really in a Russian hospital, huh? When they use vodka as the anesthetic.
Well, that was one way of telling me. All right. But it was an experience I'll never forget. I got a lot of breaks along the way, including that very day. And after I was wounded, because when the pilot lost altitude in a hurry, that saved my life. Several times I was saved. I spent 15 months in Army hospitals. When I went home, I had casts around my chest and around both arms were cast.
Sounds like you were kind of hard to hug.
I was hard to hug.
But they found a way?
I'm sure they did.
Well, when you think back about it, and as you've stated to us, so many things that saved your life, that if they had gone a little differently, you wouldn't be here. Your kids and grandchildren would have never been born. How do you make sense of all that? Why do you think things happened the way they did?
The hand of God was on my shoulder. He took care of me. What I really want people to remember is that these were ordinary folks, ordinary citizens who became soldiers, and some of them, too many of them, died the worst way.
More than 400,000 of them, and many of them on B-17 missions like the three hair-raising missions we relive today. Thanks so much for spending another hour with us today. And if you do have a chance to experience that B-17 sentimental journey in Southern California this weekend, maybe take a look at the nose and the tail and imagine how you might have handled the situations the memories of Ralph Burbridge, Duke O'Donnell, and Vern Cole brought to life for us today. I have a feeling you might just be as dumbfounded as I am, and just as grateful for another reminder that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.